York, London, Paris, Munich. Have you got a PRS license for that pop music? Hello, and welcome back to Big Mouth, the IKEA Algonquin roundtable of music, film, telly, and miscellaneous. I'm Andrew Harrison.
And I'm Sian Pattenden, the upright Billy Bookcase to Andrew's cantilevered Pwang armchair. This week, we're looking at Tracy Thorne's new album of feminist bangers called Record. Or is it Record? Or Record? What sort of pop do we get out of what them magazines are calling middle youth? And we'll be having a gander at the documentary Beats, Rhymes and Life, The Travels of a Tribe Called Quest. Not so many people saw it when it came out in 2011, but it's just landed on Netflix, now with added pathos since the death of Fife Dawg in 2016. What will we make of this hip-hopumentary? And could they have called it Rising on the Crest of a Wave that is the test of a tribe called Quest? Which I thought was more mythic. But there
it's
you
certainly more mythic. Wouldn't fit it on a poster, though, would you?
No way.
Plus, it's 20 years since the release of The Big Lebowski. Window into the soul of the modern male, best Coen Brothers movie ever, annoying quote farm, or is that just like your opinion, man? And we'll be listening to the debut album by cut and paste Dalstonites, Superorganism, and trying to work out where they got all the bits from. But first, let's perform the onboarding procedure with today's guests. Hannah Verdier writes about telly for The Guardian, where she immerses herself in future classics I Wanna Marry Harry and 100-Year-Old Driving School. She also writes about podcasts, hem, 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 here's a £10 note. And
I'll make that 20.
Make that 20. Yeah. Yeah. And she's a veteran of the smash hit School for Gifted Youngsters. Hello, Hannah. Welcome back to Big Mouth. How
Hello
you doing?
There. Good, thanks.
We saw that you stayed up all night for the entire Oscars.
Well,
did you record it and pretend?
Yeah, I pretended.
All right.
Okay. I've only seen 11 films. It's nothing except gowns to me.
It's all about the gowns. Yes. What was your favourite bit?
I'm just finding award ceremonies very dull this year. Very, very dull.
Mm.
And everything that goes with them.
Yeah. It's important that the politics is there because it's, quote, a moment. We're having a moment. And, you
yeah.
know, Hollywood drives the American culture and that's a good thing. Hollywood is what they've got instead of royalty. Did we lose the excitement and the fun that there would otherwise be in the Oscars?
I think we did. I think it started out with the Golden Globes and the decision to wear black. I mean, that should be a decision. That should be your look. You shouldn't have to do it.
Well, because people in fashion and Hollywood hate wearing black so much, don't they? Nobody exactly. in fashion wears black as the...
It's so bad on telly.
Well, it's very slimming then. that's a terrible thing for me to say in the context
that's
of now.
Right.
Isn't it?
I think that's probably what they're going for rather than any activism.
I am an enormously problematic person. You've also, in your podcasting guys or your podcast journalism guys,
oh, yeah.
you've also been highlighting The Onion's new spoof, A Very Fatal
oh,
Murder.
Oh, yes. Have you heard it? I love it.
Well, you see, I haven't heard Serial or any of those things to see what's being spoofed. I would feel I was.
I don't think you need to, though, because you kind of get what they're spoofing because it's so obvious that it makes you want to listen to the true crime podcast. But
our podcast now eating their own tail, then? Should we be doing our own spoof of this show before somebody else does?
Oh, I think we probably should. Let's do it.
Mm, OK. Well, that may actually turn out to be this very episode.
Yes, how do we know we're not doing it?
I don't know.
I'm maybe doing it now.
We're through the looking glass now, people. We're also delighted to welcome back our Australian correspondent to Big Mouth. Andrew Mueller is a Melody Maker veteran, now a contributing editor to Monocle magazine. He also regularly presents The Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio, where his incisive questioning on war, terrorism, the economy and international events belies his background in writing about Flying Nun records. He also plays in the band The Blazing Zoos, who are playing in London's Glitter in Camden Town next week. Am I right?
We are on Sunday week, March 18th. Is that the right date? Something
Could
like
well
that. At the Fiddler's Elbow.
At the Fiddler's Elbow?
Yes.
Okay.
Do come, everybody.
Give us the elevator pitch on The Blazing Zoos.
We're a noisy country-ish group. We have made two albums, one of which is better than the other. We will mostly be playing songs from the one that is better.
In which order is that?
The second one's better
oh, that's
than the
good.
First. Which is ideal. We are on
most bands can't do that.
I know. I like to think we have inverted the paradigm there. But yes, we will be appearing with three other bands whose names are not presently known to me, and I think we're on stage at around 7:30. So nice and early. Sunday evening, and you can still go home and get a night's sleep before whatever the hell it is you do on a Monday. And we're not playing for all that long, so if you don't like us, no great loss.
Raucous, noisy country at convivial hours.
That's basically us.
Fantastic. Now,
we're going to put that on the posters.
Oh, you can have that one. Now, listen, I want to ask you, given the interesting times in which we live, the ever-changing world in which we live in, Don't you ever want to pack in the current affairs stuff and go back to the comforting meaninglessness of writing about pop?
I do still indulge occasionally a bit in the comforting meaninglessness of writing about pop. But no, I mean, it is, we are living in interesting times in the Chinese curse sense of the phrase. And it actually makes the job of doing a show like The Foreign Desk for Monocle 24, midday on Saturdays, podcastable thereafter, actually extremely easy. Because when I correspond with the producers, usually on a Monday morning, about what the heck are we going to put in the show this week, it's usually like, well, here's 20 completely plausible topics we could get a good half an hour of. Which one do you want to do?
We got a bit of this with our sister show Romaniacs, also available on Apple Podcasts and other platforms, where we started out and people said, oh, that's a good idea, a podcast about Brexit. What are you going to do when you run out of material? Now it's like, have you seen the papers? Have you seen everything? We're never going to run out of material. This is going to go on forever and ever till the heat death of the universe.
Brexit is, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, until the earth spins into the sun and our Lord calls us all home. You have established a job for life there, I think.
Sadly so. Who's the most interesting person you've had on Monocle FM Foreign Desk lately? Who have you most enjoyed talking to?
It's a topical one for the current status, the current news in Britain, in that we did a thing on Russia, which we've done a few times now because it keeps coming up, a few weeks ago, but we were conjuring with the idea of life after Vladimir Putin. We were amusing ourselves with the idea that he might not win the election. Exactly. Pause for audience laughter.
Yes.
But we did ask a few people to talk about that. So we had the great Masha Gessen from The New Yorker on to talk about it, who's a terrific guest. But we also had Viktor Karamirza, who is he was an associate of Boris Nemtsov, who was famously shot dead on the bridge opposite the Kremlin. He works for Open Russia, I think, is his organization. I apologize if I've got that wrong, but he has in fact himself been poisoned twice.
Okay.
In circumstances which appear remarkably similar to that which befell the unfortunate Colonel Sergei Skripal in Salisbury this week.
I'm feeling quite nervous here.
Yeah.
You seem to have links.
Yeah. Yes. No, they haven't come for me as yet, but you know, it was interesting talking to somebody about, you know, who's obviously well aware of the risks he's running and nonetheless continues to choose to run them. Mm-hmm. It does remind you that for all the kind of, you know, passion and rancor that may be generated in a country such as this by an event such as Brexit, it's basically relatively civil compared to most places.
It's a bit different from, getting a box of human waste because you wrote a bad review of somebody's third album, isn't it? It's slightly different. Okay, in a desperate attempt to stop our listeners running off to Monocle FM, we're going to get started after this short message from Sian.
Yes, our listeners continue to play a blinder in helping to cover Big Mouth studio costs by figuratively buying us a pint each month, back of the net. As regular listeners know, we're asking you to help cover our studio expenses via the crowdfunding platform Patreon. All you need to do is pledge us the price of a virtual pint or non-alcoholic equivalent every lunar cycle. We're aiming to raise £600 a month to cover our costs, and if 120 listeners stand as the equivalent of just one drink at £5, hey, we're in London, even if you're not, then we'll get there. Once we get to that goal, we'll begin recording extra bits each week, especially for our Patreon backers. Go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more, and the link is also at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page. All we are saying is
buy us a pint.
And thanks to my mum.
Thanks to your mum
this week.
We should start doing. We're going to start name checking the backers as well very soon.
Yes, we will,
because we love them.
Yeah.
Right then, let's get cracking with Record by Tracy Thorne. 38 years in the business, mostly with Ben Watt in Everything But the Girl. She's been working solo since the turn of the century. Her fifth album in her own right, Record, is produced by electronic dance music person Ewan Pearson, and it appears to pack the entire female experience into about 34 minutes. Does it work? Is Tracy indeed every woman, and it's all in her? We're going to find out after this, the opening track. This is Queen.
Here I go again, down that road again. I haven't sold it yet. What happened if we never met? Oh, if I just ignored those sliding doors, if I turned instead from your bed, am I queen or something else? I might have been a star.
Tracy Thorne with Queen from Record. Not about dear departed Lord Frederick of Lucan, of course, but about the female experience. Now, Hannah Verdier. this is proper grown-up capital W woman pop on behalf of all womankind. So on behalf of all womankind, you're speaking for the entire gender. What did you make of it?
I have a problem that she mentioned it was 9 feminist bangers. They are feminist, but I wouldn't call them all bangers.
They're not all bangers.
But I don't think that's a bad thing. I thought on the whole it was really good. I, like a massive cliche, I was doing the washing up while I listened to it, which so I definitely am speaking for the whole of womankind there. Ironically, of course. And yeah, I liked hearing a life story through it, really.
Yeah.
And it's good to hear a woman who's in her 50s talking about things that women that age would talk about as well.
It's also good to hear a woman in her 50s doing it in the context of spangly electronics.
Yes, exactly.
Because, I mean, I like Tracy Thorn as a person to have out there, but I just, you know, acoustic twiddling is not my thing and never. I like them when they went coffee table, drum and bass. That was more my kind of thing. When they went house music, it was much more my kind of thing. And it's nice to hear, and I think really affecting to hear these concerns in the context of, you know, electronic dance music, house music, which itself is 30, 40 odd years old. You know, it's not a newfangled thing. It's the environment we've all grown up in.
Exactly. So I don't think it'll necessarily appeal to the youngsters, but it'll appeal to the people who grew up listening to music in the 80s and 90s, I think, who are into this sort of thing. But I like the way she's like no holds barred, and she says she likes being on the dance floor with a drink in her hand. That's where she's comfortable. Mm. And I think she's quite an inspiration as a person anyway.
I like the whole sort of the holistic artwork aspect of it. It's called Record. Very Pet Shop Boys title.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And all the tracks have got a single word title. You know, they're all called Babies or, you know, Smoke or Sister. I like the fact that the first three songs spell out Queen Air Guitar, because she's like the least Queen Air Guitar person.
I didn't even notice that.
This is the kind of thing you've listened to.
Thanks to Shuffle.
Yeah. Sean, on behalf of the rest of womankind.
I'm 50%. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, as you know, I was a little bit nervous about listening to this because I thought this is just going to be so M.O.R. And I like her as a person. I like this idea of Tracy Thorn. I think she is a good thing, but I'm not sure that I'm going to like the music. And quite frankly, I didn't really like the music. I like the sentiment. That's great. There's a lovely song called Smoke where she talks about being in London. Is it Smoke?
Yeah.
And her parents moving. And it's her life story. And I thought that was wonderful. And yet I just found it wasn't for me. I just found it very, very safe musically. And maybe that's the problem. However, if you went the other side, and she does have a song that's about contraception. Mm. There aren't that many bands that have a song about contraception. The other way it would have been done would be Bikini Kill or Hole or something. You wouldn't have wanted that either. So she's very cleverly sort of straddled that line.
I think it's
between content and how it sounds.
I like the fact that it's kind of it is interesting and provocative thoughts put forward in a way that's both easy to listen to but also kind of euphoric and joyful. It's, you know, things like this, you mentioned Bikini Kill and stuff like that. I think Courtney Love used to call it angry vagina music. You know,
I bet she did.
And,
yeah.
You know, that sort of like mega sort of strident full of anger stuff is great and is valid, but it's nice to hear this stuff in a different context where you can hear the words and where you can get into the sentiment. Andrew Mueller, what did you make of this?
I liked it very much. As Sean points out, the thing that it actually reminded me of, and you set the link up nicely by mentioning that there is a song about contraception, of which there are very few. The only one I could think of was The Pill by Loretta Lynn.
Too Much Too Young by The Specials, we had it on the show last week.
It does mention, but Loretta Lynn was weirdly the artist that leapt most to mind when I listened to this record, because Loretta Lynn traded very much in just sort of basic, honest, here's how it actually is, stories of workaday womanhood, which is weirdly still a quite under-discussed or under-examined area.
Yeah, maybe
area.
There is a country music strand running
in
through
pop music.
It, which is a nice
Andrew will be familiar with my attempts by now to bring literally every subject back to either country music or Australian rules football. And I am going to have a crack at both of those things during this show. But that is what it reminded me of.
It reminded you of Australian rules football?
Not so much, no. But it did remind me of those confessional country records by the likes of Loretta Lynn. And I liked it very much. And I agree with the general sentiment that Tracy Thorn is a good thing, even though I've not always been a massive fan of everything but the girl. I like her column in the New Statesman very much. She always comes across as a remarkably bright and personable presence and generally contributes to the nation's gaiety and so forth. But I liked this record as a thing more than I can recall liking other things she's done. And there's the record, it's another... It's another single word title. Is it Face? Faces?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's
yes,
a brilliant
it's
song.
It's a brilliant song because it is about how people's past relationships now exist, whether you like it or not, in this strange half-life online. And it did make me think about... It is really interesting when you watch popular culture trying to adapt to or keep up with new technology. It's like when you watch, you know, sitcoms or films of a certain age now whose plots would be rendered entirely redundant if one person owned a phone.
Well, song Face, it's to me, it's a fantastic piece of writing. It's like a Philip Larkin poem for now. It's like it's her describing how she scrolls through the Facebook page of an ex, isn't it?
She's online stalking at midnight. Mm-hmm. I find that very real.
Oh, stalking at midnight will be a fantastic disc.
It's nearly a Patsy Cline update. You could call it Stalking After Midnight.
Yeah, Stalking After Midnight. Absolutely. Yeah. It is the three cigarettes in a digital ashtray of now. But, I mean, Hannah, I mean, the writing on this, she's never been thought of as a capital W writer on the Leonard Cohen scale of hand milled lines. I think she's been badly misjudged there, because some of the stuff here, I mean, there's great lines. I think it's on the track Sister, Nobody Ever Loved Someone They're Afraid Of. These are really great little pebbles.
But I disagree with that line completely. So I just argue with that.
Okay, well, you can argue with it, but it's a good line. Yeah.
She taps into the little moments of life, I think, with the... Like with the stalking after midnight, or the kids leaving home, or wanting to be out on the dance floor and probably being stuck at home. It's those little moments that I would say men probably do, but a lot of women go through, and I think she's putting them out really well. And I think she's a really likeable character as well.
Yeah. My one of the thoughts that leapt out to me was, like, how does Ben Watt take this? Because a lot of these songs are about guilt and resentment towards exes and relationships, and how, you know, there's a song, I think it's called Guitar, about... like the early boyfriend who thinks he's the star, but she's got a guitar and she outgrows him. There's Face, where she's stalking this ex and resenting it.
I wonder how he feels.
And they've been together for like 30-odd years and married for 10, 15, something like
that. But we come back to the thing of it might not be her. She might be talking about her daughter's experience looking at Facebook. She has friends. She has a song called Oh, The Divorces. And as we know, that in interviews, she would always say, people go, you're getting divorced? No, I wrote about my friends who are getting divorced. Mm. So again, this projection going on. Mm. I imagine Ben Watt's a lovely man and is very supportive.
Johnny Cash did not shoot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
Yeah. No, he didn't. But then I wouldn't have put it past him. There's so much in so much on this record that feels extremely raw and personal. You kind of think, can it all be imagination? I mean, evidently
but
it is.
But isn't that not just good writing?
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly it. It is really good writing. But then all writing is drawn from personal experience, no matter how much...
Yeah, but you might not act on it, as Andrew Miller's saying. She might fancy someone, she's not going to act on it.
No, but there is an extent where you might hear this song about... resentment to an early lover or to someone that you split up with, and think that material's got to come from somewhere. I don't know. But you're right. It is fantastic, top quality writing. And
but you asked what Ben Watt thinks of it. What does her mum think of it? What do her daughters think of it?
Yes.
He doesn't own her.
No, he doesn't own
her.
No.
And wasn't it Muriel Gray who once said you can't write anything without selling somebody out?
Oh, it's The Shard of Glass, Graham Greene as well.
Okay.
Yeah, it's about having the shard of glass in your heart.
Great
mind. You'll sell anyone out.
Yeah.
Once had a love, turned out was a shard of glass. Well, I found it both very moving and also top points for being concise at 35 minutes, because we're all busy people. We're all busy people. And if you can fit the entire female experience into 35 minutes, then I take my hat off to you. And it does end on a kind of euphoric note with dance floor, doesn't it? With, you know, it's prime happy sad music. Do we think this is kind of evidence that, you know, middle age is no longer boring and old? Please God, say yes.
Oh, definitely. I don't think it has been for years, actually. I can't remember my middle-aged parents being boring.
They were never being boring.
I think it's still relatively unusual, which is strange when you consider how many middle-aged people are now making music, to hear middle age actually addressed in pop music, because obviously one of the appeals of pop is the license it gives you to stay young forever, which is I notice with a deep sigh that the Rolling Stones are touring yet again, who are now men in their mid 70s who have refused to acknowledge anything that's happened to
them. Mick Jagger had
years.
A baby in the last few years as well. They will never acknowledge that they're older.
He had a baby.
He fathered a baby.
Exactly,
it's still his.
It's the easy part. That's the easy part.
He's paying for it. Mm. Okay, let's have some more music. We always ask our guests to bring in a tune for the audience, their own editor's recommendation. Hannah Verdier, what do you have for us?
Oh, as always, I like to bring some funk. And
I have, it brings the funk.
They, as often said about me, I've got some Parliament, which is their first song under the Parliament name since 1980. And I'm quite excited about what George Clinton comes up with now, because he said he wants to collaborate with Cardi B, which
is
would be my dream.
He is not. He is.
No,
yeah.
He's 1,000 years old.
And it doesn't matter. Yeah,
exactly.
He's still bringing it.
I've met him. It was very strange.
You're kidding?
Really?
No.
No way.
No, I met him in his house at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh. Okay.
In Tallahassee.
Had you gone around to borrow a cup of sugar or something?
No, I was on tour with Drive-By Truckers and the Hold Steady, and the buses were preparing to leave the venue in Tallahassee, and somebody just came out and said, do you all want to come around and meet George Clinton? He switched on the mothership. So we said, yeah. So these two enormous tour buses rumbled through the suburbs of Tallahassee till we found this. It's a small bungalow from which you can see through the front window from some distance away the lights flashing of the massive flying saucer, which he has in his lounge room.
Oh, so the mothership's in a bungalow?
The mothership is in a bungalow in Tallahassee. And the really cool thing about it was, as the two bands and their road crew and attendant freeloading journalists just sort of wandered into his house at 3 o'clock in the morning, he barely looked up. You get the impression, this just happens.
This is just business for
him. Just like a whole bunch of people just walking into my house to get their pictures taken in front of the mothership. It was a strange evening.
Well, this track has a better title than The Mothership is in a Bungalow. It is called Hannah. What's it called?
I'm going to deliver it in the whitest, unfunkiest way possible here. This Parliament track is called I'm Gonna Make You Sick of Me.
I'm gonna make you sick. I'm gonna make you sick of me. Then I'm gonna give you the antidote.
Something to make you better.
I'm gonna make you sick. I'm gonna make you sick of me. Then I'm gonna give you the antidote.
I'm Gonna Make You Sick of Me, featuring Scarface by Parliament. George Clinton there, who also has a successful franchise, Clinton's Cards, very good stationery. And sticking with the actual P-Funk, let's have a look at that documentary about the mighty hip-hop quartet, A Tribe Called Quest. Director Michael Rappaport's Beats, Rhymes and Life was a bit of a hit in America when it came out in 2011. But in Britain, unless you live near an artsy cinema which charges you £10 more to sit in a seat five times wider, yes, we know the ones, you may well have missed it. Which is why we have Netflix. Yay! The movie debuted there last week. What do we think of it, and how does it look in the light of the sudden death of Fife Dawg from complications from diabetes in 2016? To set the mood, here's A Tribe Called Quest with Award Tour.
People give you ear, so I be sublime. It's enjoyable to know you and the concubines. Niggas, take off your coats. Ladies, act like gems. Sit down, Indian styles, you recite these hymns. See, lyrically, I'm Mario Andretti on the Momo. Ludicrously speedy or infectious with the slow-mo. Heard me in the 80s, JV's on the promo. Am I never in the quest to get the paper on the caper? But now, let me take it to the queen side.
Tribe Called Quest with Award Tour, as heard a little bit in Beats, Rhymes and Life, The Travels of A Tribe Called Quest on Netflix now. So, what's the scenario? Andrew Mueller, how are you on the old hip-hop?
Sketchy. I would go with sketchy.
How are you on the...
Intermittent.
Okay, how are you on A Tribe Called Quest?
I like A Tribe Called Quest. I liked A Tribe Called Quest at the time. And I liked this film, but it did... It's kind of... With films like this... They have become a genre unto themselves at this point, and the identity and indeed genre of the group becomes somehow entirely irrelevant as you realise that it's basically the same experience within some constraints to everybody who ever forms any kind of group. It is a really weird thing for people to do and a really strange way for people to live.
Well, to decide that you're going to like nail your life to a group of mates who you knew when you were 19, and in this case, when you were in primary school, and you're going to stick with them into an unknowable future is a very odd thing for anybody to do.
Well, I'm reminded of the best encapsulation of it I think I've read was in Robert Forster's wonderful book, Grant and I, about him and Grant McLennan forming the Go-Betweens. And he described forming a pop group as the most romantic thing that two heterosexual men can do together.
I mean, I think Andy's right. It is the story of every band. You kind of start off with your mates and the band makes you fall out with your mates. But I thought it was actually told in an original and really kind of compassionate way, actually. Particularly, obviously, dramatic irony. We now know what happens to poor old Fife Dog. And this film ends, this is not a spoiler, this film ends with a kind of rapprochement and a kind of reunion. I mean, the gist of it is that Q-Tip's a bit of a dick and Fife feels a bit betrayed by Q-Tip. But Fife's health problems start to surface in the middle of the movie, don't they?
I think they're kind of looking out for each other, and the rest of the band are trying to tell him to look after himself. And he's talking about his addiction to sugar, and I found it quite touching. And he's talking about diabetes, and obviously knowing what we know now.
Yeah,
I was quite moved by that, and also for their love for each other, despite them having fights all the time. There was a lot of love there.
Yeah, I mean it's the framing of the story works really well because it begins. Rappaport sets it up with the supposedly the last gig ever, where they're fighting and they hate each other, and you kind of think, oh my God, I don't want to see this. I've come to see the story of a group that I like, and I don't want to see this kind of hate-filled thing where it's all falling apart. But it arcs through that and right back to a deeper understanding of who's who in the band and why they are that way.
Yeah.
I particularly liked seeing the inside story of the school they all went to. Somebody should make a movie about that school, because it just seems to be this kind of creative fountain.
And St. Albans. Ever. I was thinking, I know St. Albans. It's not like that, and then realised obviously it's not the same St. Albans that gave us James Brown.
Yeah.
But what I didn't know, and that's probably me being ignorant, is the whole Native Tongues movement and how many bands and artists were in there, and they're all complete bangers. Everyone that was involved, really.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the really likeable thing about the kind of earlier midsection of the movie is just the pure joy of young people discovering that they're really good at something. And you get the impression that all four of them, they would have been a success at anything they did because they had that drive and that ability.
But they're also doing something new. And when you see a new genre invented, and to go back, I felt really nostalgic for that. So, and Jurassic 5, Tribal Quest, Jungle Brothers, that Native Tongues group, and then with De La Soul, you just think, God, actually, yes, it still sounds like the revolution. It still sounds really fresh and exciting. I really like the geeky bits of where they got the samples from. Yeah. He's going through the vinyl. And to hear the originals and then to hear the track again, just to be reminded of that sound, I thought that was really joyous before they all fall out. That was just like, I'd watch it again for that first section just to see that.
But it's amazing how common that dynamic of the band falling out and falling back in for one reason or another is. And it reminds me a bit of what we were saying earlier about the joys of pop made by middle-aged people, is that in my experience of knowing people who've been in bands for a long time, especially if there's been an interregnum, they may have fallen rancorously out and then gotten back together. Without exception that I can think of, everybody says it's so much more fun the second time around. Hmm. Yeah, because nobody at this point thinks I desperately have to get everything right. I have everything to prove right now.
But we don't even get to that bit with this because one of them's off.
Well, indeed.
That's the shame of it, they can't revisit it.
And ideally, everybody is, 20 or 30 years older. And ideally, once you're 20 or 30 years older, hopefully slightly less of an idiot than you were in your early 20s.
Well, the codas to the story is, of course, they do make another album, which we talked about on the show sort of about 18 months ago. And it is both a kind of rapprochement on record. It's also kind of, it's their farewell to Fife, because he died before they finished it. And it's called Thank You For Your Service. And that's got a lot of, all the things that you hope would happen at the end of this movie actually kind of do happen, apart from Fife surviving, and that, to me, that's, I think it's this, there's more in this film now than there maybe was when it came out in 2011 to see and to take in.
Can I tell you one of my favourite bits?
Yes.
It's when Ali says that he basically invented how you do a hip-hop record. He says, I made everyone do this. He doesn't say in my accent. He says, you say your name, you say the name of your crew, and then you do your rhyme. And I just thought that's something to live by.
Yes.
I'm going to say my name to the woman in the shop. I'm going to invent my crew, and I'm going to say these are the things I want to buy.
I'm Sean Patton, and I'm from Big Mouth. I'd like a dozen eggs, please.
Yeah, actually, it's not going to work.
Okay. Well, I don't know. It's out to you again. Yeah. I liked the fact that, as well as it being something that you can absorb as I think it's fair to say we're all the general audience, aren't we? None of us is kind of deep hip-hop people. But enough characters pop up that you remember from, I've heard that in hip-hop legend, DJ Cool Herc appears looking like the craziest old guy. He looks like a mad old man at a bus stop. Mm. But they've clearly got so much love for him and he really knows his stuff. This is basically the inventor of hip-hop.
Yeah.
And, you get to see, the Beastie Boys. Another poignant aspect of this is, we don't have a full deck of Beastie Boys anymore. Yeah. It's very sad. But clearly Rappaport, he knows his stuff and he's clearly really into it. As an actor, he's had a bit of a checkered path. he was in, you know, he's in True Romance and a lot of stuff kind of basically at the end of the last century, and it all went quiet. And he, you know, he clearly has a real understanding of this and a talent as a director.
But there was rancor, was there not, between him and A Tribe Called Quest over this film?
There may well have been. Well, I did notice, because I'm the kind of person who looks at little things on credits, that the holding company for the movie is called Beats, Rhymes and Fights. So clearly there was a little bit of creative tension.
I think you're right.
Do you think that's... Well, I mean, I don't know much about that. I mean, is this...
I think there was a thing where a Tribe Called Quest or various members thereof wanted perhaps more control over how their story was going to be told than the director really wanted to give them, which is not an unfamiliar tension, I think, in the world of journalism and documentary making.
I think it's fair to say in this room we'll all be on the side of the director, though, won't we? Because fans never want warts and all. And they don't understand that warts and all is actually will actually make people like you more. Warts and all will make people understand who you are and why you are the way you are.
But it did remind me, I guess, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that these films do, or you cannot help but be reminded of other similar films. The obvious parallel, though the music could not be more different, did strike me as Anvil! Exclamation yes. mark, which is that great film about the hapless Canadian heavy metal group. But again, just becomes a story of you know, friendship and defiance of the odds and determination to succeed and so forth.
Well, Tolstoy said every family is unhappy in its own way, and rock documentaries prove that all bands are unhappy in exactly the same way. They've all got the same reason to hate Some Kind of Monster. The Metallica documentary is exactly the same. Should we move on and have another choice of music from one of our guests? Andrew Mueller, what have you brought for the class?
I think this song's 2 or 3 years old, but it's a very favourite artist of mine, Cor Blund, the great Canadian country singer, who was in London recently, so I went to see him because that's always fun. He's a terrific artist, and he was appearing solo this time without his usual backing band, the Hurt and Albertans. The Hurt and Albertans.
Okay.
As they are known.
That's amazing.
Whom my band, the Blazing Zoos, who are playing on Sunday week, have opened for a couple of times. But no, he's a great, great songwriter. He's possibly slightly... hobbled from the mainstream success he deserves by the fact that he insists on writing songs about Canada as opposed to the United States. And he is a big deal in Canada, mm-hmm. a properly big deal. In the US, I think, where people don't really understand what Saskatchewan is, it's possibly a bit of a struggle. But the song I chose is a song from an album of his a couple of years ago, which... One of the things I like about country music is you can almost always tell just by looking at the title that this is going to be a great song. And when I got a hold of this album and just saw the title on the track listing, Bible on the Dash, you know this is going to be a great song about being on the road in a country band. It's a duet by him of him and the Texan singer-songwriter Hayes Carl. I suspect it's about 8/10 of true stories with possibly a little more larded on top for dramatic effect.
Okay, well, let's have a listen. I never knew you were so big on Corblandism. Jeremy Corbland with Bible on the Dash.
Two nights standing in Tulsa, pulling out and headed west. Brady grabbed the Gideons from the hotel in the desk, and we said, what's the matter, brother? Are you worried about your soul? He said, better safe than sorry, boys. That's just how I roll. We hit the road, feeling cool as crossed the stairs in Nash, overflowing with the spirit and the Bible on the dash.
The world-changing appeal of Corblundism. That was Corblund with Bible on the Dash, as chosen by Andrew Mueller. Now, it's 20 years since the release of The Big Lebowski, Joel and Ethan Coen's stoner comedy, which resembled a Raymond Chandler novel adapted by Cheech and Chong. It puzzled the critics and was a comparative failure at the box office, but after two decades, the story of the dude, his rug, Walter, his hair trigger Vietnam veteran friend, a severed toe, a porn director, and a group of German nihilists has become the very acme of cult moviedom. I love it. Andrew Mueller only made it 15 minutes into the movie, I think, first time around. Will the dude abide at a distance of 20 years, or are our guests about to enter a world of pain? Let's get in the mood.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in. I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
You've got to admit, that really ties the movie together. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in by Kenny Rogers and the First Edition from one of the key dream sequences in The Big Lebowski. Hannah Verdier, were you on board for The Big Lebowski first time around?
Not massively, no. I do like the Coen brothers, but I find these kind of cult movies very catchphrasey, stonery, male-dominated. All the things I'm not massively into, really.
All the things I love.
Yeah, but having said that, I think Jeff Bridges is amazing in it. I do like the dude, but I think it just gets a bit tiresome.
Did you watch it when it was out first time around, or have you?
Yeah, but it didn't really make any impact. And then I watched it again, and I thought, oh, this is a cult movie. I'm going to really love it. And I struggled with it, and I feel ashamed saying that even.
I suppose there's a difference between watching something when it just appears, and then watching something in the framework of this is a cult movie.
Yes.
I'm watching a cult movie
Why?
Now
and
that
then
everybody
you start to question
yes.
it.
Yeah. Sean, what did you think of it?
Well, I watched it when it came out, before its cult movie status, as we're saying. And I've watched it a few times since because I really liked the movie. And it was only recently, I have watched it about five or six times, that it just hit me. It's a film noir.
Yeah.
It's a film noir with Jeff Bridges and an anti-hero who's just happens to really like his rug and having a bit of a smoke. And that's all he wants to do. But it has all the elements of film noir. It has Hollywood, it has drugs, it has porn, it has strange Europeans. It's got guns.
Most of it happens at night.
Yes, I mean, you can just take, but there's about 25 different elements of film noir there that's got the same sort of plot. And as that struck me, I enjoyed it even more. Yeah.
It's like, what would an Elmore Leonard book be like if instead of it being driven by detection and a protagonist?
Well, he is a detective. He has something to find out.
Yeah, but he's not really. He's just ambling through.
He doesn't want to be.
He's ambling through the action.
Yeah, he's unwilling, but he is. Yes, he needs to find out, you know, what's happened to the woman. He doesn't want to, but what's happened to the young wife.
But what he'd really like to do is just sit at home drinking White Russians.
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
Which is much more sensible.
Yeah.
Andrew Mueller, did you make it through more of The Big Lebowski this time around than the first time around?
I did. When I told you beforehand that I'd only got about 15 minutes into it the first time, that wasn't inaccurate. Obviously, it's one of those films that if you spend enough time on tour buses, you will end up seeing quite a lot more of it in installments, because it is one of those films, like With Nail and I, or This Is Spinal Tap, or insert your own favourite cult film here, which is a comforting source of familiar catchphrases that makes people happy when they're far from home. I did get slightly further into it in an attempt to watch it.
How far
in one
did you
go.
Get?
Most of the way. I mean, it's
so you didn't see the Great Big Country Show at the end that they do with all your favourite Australian and Canadian country acts.
Yeah, no, I had a bit about cricket.
Strangely, I didn't. I'm also burdened by an irrational hatred of dream sequences in absolutely all their forms. So there is that. It's okay. It's charming in its way. Jeff Bridges is really, really good. I also just have, and this is my thing, not the movie's thing, just a general aversion to most things stoner. Mm. Most people who are stoned I find incredibly boring. Quite a lot of art created to amuse people who are stoned I find also incredibly boring. Cheech and Chong, who you mentioned, I have, you're probably detecting a theme emerging here, have always
reggae?
Found incredibly boring. Not a massive fan of reggae.
Me too.
Get
no,
out!
That's
the show
it.
Is over,
it's
you're both
sad. It's so boring.
Get off my show.
Yes, as the old joke has it, what did one reggae fan say to the other when the dope wore off? God, this music's awful.
And
I think The Big Lebowski, possibly you could tell the same gag about.
Well, I'm going to bat that one back to you, because I'm not a stoner in any respect. I'm actually frightened of drugs. I find them frightening. And I find this entirely charming and entertaining, because it's really about aimless, bumbling guys tossed into a story they can't get out of. Mm. It's trapped on rails they can't get off. So, you know, the dude isn't really a protagonist with a mission. He's just
he's
got
unwilling.
A little
he's
few local concerns.
Coincidence.
But he is. Yes, coincidence.
Coincidence.
Write that down. That looked better in print.
Yeah.
But through the stupid behaviour of Walter with his obsessions about, you know, this will not stand.
I quite like Walter.
Well, yeah.
Walter,
based on John Milius, apparently. They based him on John Milius' behaviour.
He even looks like John Milius.
He looks like John Milius.
Yeah.
You know, this will not stand. I'll never take a step backwards. And his strange obsession with being Jewish, even though he isn't. you know, Walter's actions push the dude forward into this world of pain. You know, being embroiled with the actual Lebowski, the rich guy whose wife has disappeared, and then attacked by these German nihilists. It's kind of, it's a story that the dude would just like to step out of. He would just like to be left alone. And that's what I find kind of touching about it, in that, like, lots of guys are like that. We really just like to bumble along doing nothing, and we don't like being put on the rails of narrative and made to follow a script and made to go on a quest.
And that's what it's about, yeah. It is about being a man, I think, that film, but I still think it's accessible. I'm not a stoner. I really like that film. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Donnie in particular, the third member of the triumvirate, Steve Buscemi is Donnie, who's just this kind of sweet, you know...
And gets told to F off all the time. The only thing that Walter ever says to him is F off Donnie.
Shut the fuck up, Donnie, member of the bowling team. Well, all, you know, all he wants to do is bowl.
Yeah.
And yet he is dragged along by the kind of, you know, the momentum of this foolish thing.
Yeah, and these idiotic rich people who are just playing with these poor people. And it also has that element to it, that they can just ask about, and the artist, played by Julianne Moore, can play with people as and when she wants to, because she's got lots of money.
Well, let's talk about those two characters. The Big Lebowski himself, who looks and sounds like Dick Cheney. The confrontation between the dude and the Big Lebowski. Well,
again, this is where I possibly identify myself as not quite the target audience, because when the actual Lebowski starts yelling at the dude to, you know, pull himself together and get
you
a
were
job,
on his side.
I did find myself
as the son of someone in the army.
Yeah, I did find myself nodding along at that point.
Your revolution is over, Mr. Lebowski. The bomb's lost. Yet the dude is kind of philosophical about this. And if you ever make it to, if you ever, you know, buckle down, Andrew, and follow your own advice and make it to the end of the movie, you'll see how. Now, the end of the movie reflects on that particular scene, and it's not, you know, perhaps we shouldn't be just on the side of the Big Lebowski. Do we think that, I'm asking this of our guests, are you put off by the fact that it's a cult movie? That you think it's a cult, it must be rubbish?
I do have a certain element of rebellion there. Well, why is it a cult movie? Oh, yeah, I kind of, if something's got that tag, I'm sort of determined not to like it so much, because I just think it wouldn't be very good. I think it's not a box office hit.
It's not a box office hit. It must be rubbish.
It's not Dumb and Dumber, so it must be rubbish.
So you haven't been, you wouldn't go and see The Room then, or oh God, I've forgotten the name of the movie that is about The Room, The Disaster Artist. So you wouldn't go and see The Disaster Artist.
Andrew, I've seen 11 films in my life. I need to choose very carefully.
You people, I don't know. Well, to me, I mean, what I like about it is that you've basically got the highest possible filmmaking skills of, you know, direction and visual imagination applied to something massively trivial and foolish. And I love that. I like the idea that... And every single character that we're supposed to hate has portentous speeches. And every character we love, just, it's like, that's just your opinion, man. I find that really charming. So I'm basically, you and I, Sean.
Yeah, I really like it, and I'm going to still think about it being the most amazing modern film noir that no one has realised, apart from all of us. Moving on. We've always got time for young bands on Big Mouth, always. Now, Super Organism is an 8-piece East London cut-and-paste tinkly-tinkly spoons on the fader behind the hi-hat outfit. The story is that most of them share a house in East London, of course, and they toss bits of tracks back and forth, working together but separately. It's that modern. The result is a bit like the Avalanches or the Go Team, and a bit like Pavement with a toy sampler. Enemy called them 2017's buzziest band, as if they were made of bees. But do they actually sound like the sneaker pimps sharing an Uber with My Little Pony? Will we like it? Will we hate it? Will we understand it because we're over 17? Let's find out after this track. Something for your mind.
I know you think I'm a psychopath, Democrat lurking in the dark. This sucks, I'm the Kmart soldier, so do trash. I kept the stash of coca candy straight from Japan, hologram, and she was never as thin. Think you know what I need to get by.
Something for your mind.
Something for Your Mind by Super Organism. Pitchfork said, if the internet had an in-house band, it might sound a little like Super Organism. That sample, of course, is from The Power, Something for Your Mind, Your Body and Your Soul, the old house music classic. Hannah Verdier, you're a pop person. What did you make of it?
I'm a bit divided on it, actually. I was driving along the other day and I heard Everybody Wants to Be Famous on Radio 1, and I thought, oh, this is all right. But I just don't think it lives up to the hype, really.
Mm.
I think it's good enough, but it's not amazing. I don't think they have the pop hooks that they think they do, even if they've borrowed a few. I just don't. And I think maybe I start to think it's not for people my age, but then, you know, when, what was it, 10 years ago, we had a bit of new rave, we had a bit of like Hadouken and all that, and I thought that had a load of energy about it and it was amazing, and this is just a bit too laid back for me.
Well, you know, people our age are listening to the Avalanches back last year after 17 years of sitting on a couch in Melbourne or wherever they live. You know, I don't think we're kind of ruled out of it.
No, and it does appeal to all ages, so I don't think that's the problem. I just don't think it has enough tunes on it.
It is the most deliberately ramshackle music imaginable, isn't it? And it's full of, you know, it's everything left field and very few song structures.
Yeah, and I don't think it's quite dancey enough. That's my problem with it.
Andrew Mueller, what did you reckon to this? This is definitely your cup of tea, isn't it? This has got Mueller written all over it.
Well, as the album is characterised, or was characterised there by Sian's very eloquent introduction of it, it is an album which might have been conceived, composed, written and produced and then distributed specifically to irritate me.
They're going to put that on the sticker on the front
exactly.
of the CD.
Yeah, exactly. Did I hate it? I didn't care enough about it. I'm very much not its target audience to invert the famous Bill Hicks quip, I am the dog being shown the card trick, in this particular instance. It has absolutely nothing to do with me. I don't really understand any of it. And which is fine, by the way. They would probably realise that, hang on, if he gets it, we've got real problems. I don't know. I thought it came across as insufferably pleased with itself, not really about anything apart from the fact that we just wanted to make this kind of zany, wacky record. There aren't any tunes, and
don't you think that we're drowning in music that's about things? I'm sick of things that are about things. I mean, I really like the Tracy Thorn record because it's tales we haven't really been told. But I'm actually tired of didactic pop and didactic rock.
No, I don't want music to be didactic. Far from it. In fact, I object almost violently to being told what to think. But it was just one of those things where I was unable to answer the always crucial question of like, why am I listening to this? Beyond the fact that I'm going
told you to.
Beyond the fact that Andrew told me to, because I'm going on Big Mouth to talk about it. There is no other reason why I would have got all the way from the start of it all the way to the end.
God, it's only 33 minutes.
You
could almost fit the end of the Big Lebowski into the time it takes to listen to this record.
At the age we have reached, 33 minutes has a premium that it did not have where people were able to spend any amount of that and other amounts of time making this pointless footling record.
Well, not everything's for everybody, I'll give you that. Sian, what did you think of Superorganism?
I thought that a few tracks of theirs were very good indeed. Anything that is called the Prawn Song, I'm going to applaud loudly.
Which is about the social behaviour of prawns.
Yeah, so you think the Prawn Song, that's going to be, you know, like really surface. Yeah, I learned quite a lot about sea life
during
that.
He's saying, for heaven's sake, if it was on Blue Planet and it was David Attenborough, he'd be totally sitting there with it, with biscuits and a cup of tea, you know. But it's on a record, so it's not allowed, apparently.
So there were elements of that, the silliness of it, and as they're having fun, and if you listen to it in headphones as I did, walking and then going on a train, I'm looking around me to look for the sirens and to look for the clattering spoons.
Is that on the record, or is it happening?
Nothing, yes, exactly. I really love that. Quite disjointed.
Nothing worse than young people having fun.
You are such an old man. You really have reached it, if you feel that. No, I enjoy those elements. I think there's loads of song structure underneath. I think that hits that famous song, I Don't Like It, has been in my head all day now. It's catchy. I found the Hope Sandoval, you know, the Mazzy Star element of this very lazy, lethargic way of singing, even though I think she's Japanese.
She's called Orana Noguchi.
Yes, and she looks amazing, but really she's so bored. And I just thought, could you sort of just G it up a bit, or we could do something different?
Do you think it needs a rowetta? Needs some pipes.
Every song
wonderful
needs a
rowetta,
It needs a lungsmith on it.
Yeah, maybe a tuneful lungsmith to get a bit of backing vocal. BV's on the... I thought the remixes are going to be good, didn't I? I got all quite excited, and yes, I am 17 again.
Yeah, Joe Goddard from Hot Chip did one of them. It's quite good. I really like this record because I thought it was joyful. And it is silly, and I think that's a bonus. And it is atonal and ramshackle, and I like that. It is the sound of people having fun with whatever they can lay their hands on. And when you're listening to the record and you don't know whether it's the phone on the record going off or whether it's in your house or has somebody flushed the toilet? No, it's on the record.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Quite a lot of thought has gone into the structure, I think, because it begins with an alarm. It begins with mourning and Arona being asked, the singer Arona being asked, does she want to get up and do some stuff today, or would she rather just do nothing? And she opts to just do nothing. And we go on this journey of faffing about and nothingness, and we end with going to bed.
Yes, and which is lovely.
Quite charming. And you can fit the whole day into 33 minutes. That's quite good as well. I was strongly reminded of Beck and also Brand Van 3000.
Oh.
Who remembers Brand Van 3000?
You're invoking Beck and Brand Van 3000 again, like those are good things.
Brand Van 3000 were great.
Beck's all right.
Beck's great. No, he's not.
We'll fight you
Beck
outside.
Beck is great, and Brand Van 3000 were great. The prognosis is discosis, as they said, quite accurately. No, I mean, this is, I like bargain bin, brand tub pop, where you chuck it all together and you bricolage it, and I think they've done a good job here. And I think the fact that Andrew hates it is a good thing, because we shouldn't all like the same thing.
Well, again, there's another quote for the posters.
Yes. So, but I can actually see why people would find it really annoying. So that's Super Organism's new album, available now in all your favourite streaming formats. And the clock is running down, which means it's time for closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing as they drain the last of that room temperature lager in their local Witherspoons this weekend as the towels go up?
Witherspoons, I like that.
Yeah, well, you know, they're spreading it around. So it's not always a fancy pants artisan ale thing. Hannah Verdier, I believe you have something about the young people enjoying themselves.
Yeah, I've got something to get off my chest, if I'm honest.
Go on, then.
We've had clean eating, we've had clean sleeping. Now it appears we're having clean raving. I read something at the weekend about a quarter of 16 to 24-year-olds don't drink, and there are these nights that are a little more laid back than we'd be used to, where they play a bit of funk, they play a bit of disco, but they lay off the techno so it doesn't get too intense. Now, I think this is ridiculous. I think people should be putting more effort in at that age to having more fun.
So this is raving without booze and without Roman jugs, and basically keeping it all clean and serene.
Yeah, keeping the music clean. And I'm thinking Clean Bandit might be involved here.
Do you believe them?
Is this
really happening?
Haven't they basically just invented staying home?
Yeah, but this annoys me. I experienced this for myself a couple of months ago. I went to a Sofa Sounds gig where you sit around someone's house on the floor, and when they introduced it, a millennial introduced it and said, I've been to far too many gigs where people were talking, laughing, singing along. This isn't about that. And I thought, that's a gig, mate.
Yeah. I'm starting to change my opinion of the young folk right here. I think they've totally got the message. Don't talk, don't make noise, don't ever leave the house. Where do
don't
I sign?
Don't go buy a pint.
Exactly.
So
sounds marvellous.
I do wonder, actually, how widespread that it is. I mean, are there actual nights like this? Are there a lot of them? Or is it the kind of thing that gets in the Guardian?
And there's the theory that people don't go out every weekend. They save up for an event like this. And
how much do they cost, these events?
I don't know. I think they're saving their energy.
Oh, I see. Rather than the pennies.
When I was 18, if I stayed in for a week, I would be going mad. I'd want to be out in a field somewhere.
But
we fought the wars for these people.
We fought the rave wars for these people. The difference is, though, we could go out and get into something for £8 and then spend £30 on drink and entertainment. And now it probably costs £40 to get into these things. So no wonder you have to drink tap water.
I suppose so.
But there is a broader social thing at play here, isn't there? Which is that generally the young people aren't drinking as much. And generally, we finally achieved the fall in drug use that people have been trying for years, because drugs are not fashionable anymore.
Yeah, and that makes
no fun.
That makes me extremely happy. But it's just the thought that everything has to be so sanitised, like when it seeps into the music.
I think it's cyclical. I think the reason they don't want to drink and they don't want to take drugs is because terrible, sad old people our age did it very publicly throughout the 90s, and we're always getting messy and being lads and ladettes. And
that's a horrible sight, isn't it?
It's revolting. And they looked at that and thought, I don't want to be like that. And I kind of don't blame them.
But is it just control over themselves? Like, they have control over what they eat, they have to eat their avocados. I don't know. I think there might be something more sinister. Okay. They don't want to be seen on social media.
No,
that
point there, it was a theory floated by young people to whom I am actually related, who I had this conversation with, and they said, no, if you go out and make a complete clown of yourself now, someone will take a picture and it will be on the internet forever and ever and ever.
Andrew Mueller, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I was forewarned by you that you were going to pick something excruciatingly nerdish. so this is my preemptive hold my beer moment.
Okay.
Can I drop something on this table with a satisfying whomp?
Yes, we'll see if we can capture the sound of it.
Okay.
Sophie, the producer, is now
satisfying whomp coming up.
That's a pretty wump.
No, this is excruciatingly nerdish. The Australian rules football season starts at the end of March, which is proper football. The Australian Football League record, the matchday publication, produces this magnificent volume every year at the start of the season.
Can you describe the cover?
The season record. The cover features Dustin Martin of Richmond.
That's not at all homoerotic, is it? Look at his muscles. Look at his cheekbones. I mean,
That is Dustin Martin, who last season had arguably the best season a footballer has ever put together. Yes,
yeah.
Won the Premiership and the Brownlow Medal and the Norm Smith Medal and various other things as well. But no, it is 1,250 very thin pages of statistical and historical minutiae.
Look at those stats.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Pertaining
to the Australian Football League. It's marvellous. I feel like I have been suckered here because this was going to be my moment where I trumped the excruciatingly nerdish thing that Andrew was going to talk about, whereas now I'm worried he'll just name something really cool and I'll just look like a massive weirdo.
We'll see about that. Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
What I've been getting into is the headlines surrounding Martin Shkreli's Wu-Tang Clan album, which seems to he bought this Wu-Tang Clan
album. He's the horrible farmer bro.
That put up his prices 5,000%. And he's being done by the feds and all this sort of thing. But he bought the only copy of a Wu-Tang Clan album for $2 million. And he's had to give it back. But not only did he buy this only copy, I think 2015, Wu-Tang Clan was so annoyed that he had bought the only copy. They diss him and all the songs, stuff like that. And they really hate him.
Well, he probably loves that.
Yes, absolutely. I'm loving the soap opera now of what are they going to do next and what's he going to do next. And it seems to be, you know, if you go down an article on the internet and there's so many different articles to click on that are related, they're all related. And I like the idea that this album has taken on this talisman effect and now sort of exists in a meta space beyond all of our control and understanding and may do something really exciting in the future. Just the album itself, it's sitting there somewhere, isn't it? I don't know what format.
What kind of headlines are they? Is it a rotten farmer bro thing?
Yeah, they're all like that. They're all Wu-Tang forever. And then when you get down to the page, they're also the Wu-Tang Clan suing the Wu-Tang Clan. Which was a doggy care centre. And they're suing them because they didn't want them to use. There's a whole world here I'm discovering. And so I'm just going to, this week, I'm just going to look into this and see what metaphors are coming up.
Okay, well, you've got to protect your IP, I suppose. My closing time chatter. It is nerdy. It's well nerdy. The great black African-American writer Ta-Nehisi Coates is taking over Captain America. He's going to be writing the Captain America comic. This is the first time, I believe the first time, it's possible it's been done once or twice in the past, but as a big marquee moment that an African-American writer is taking over the absolute tentpole, US comics character, the guy who literally is the flag. And I think this is very exciting because Ta-Nehisi Coates has been writing Black Panther for the past couple of years, and he's fed into the Black Panther movie, which has been such an enormous hit and so many people have loved. To give him this, for once the word is deserved, icon, to do with what he will, I think it actually says a really good thing about comics.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's actually, we had a Black Captain America briefly, the Falcon became Captain America briefly, and there was a great story a while ago where, I mean, the origin story of Captain America is he's the product of experiments before the war to create a super soldier. And there was a little kind of prequel to it where they basically started out by practicing on black soldiers, which would be what would happen. You know, you don't you know, in the way the American military was in those days, they wouldn't have gone straight in on a white guy. They would have, let's test it out on the black regiments. And there was a great story about how that, what that said about the racism in the American military at the time, what that said about how, African-Americans have been treated before, since, during and since the war, Tuskegee Airmen, all that kind of stuff. And I just think it's great that this cultural icon, this powerful symbol, can be placed in the hands of somebody who's going to do something different with it. And it's going to start next year, or this year rather, and the first issue comes out on the 4th of July.
It's also going to annoy lots of really angry people who deserve to be annoyed.
That's the other really, really nice thing about it. So I'm really looking forward to that. So Ta-Nehisi Coates' Captain America coming out in July. And that, I believe, is the end of the show. Thank you to our guests, Hannah Verdier and Andrew Mueller. What are you both up to next? Hannah, what have you got on next?
I'd like to say something exciting, but looking after a sick child.
Oh, well, there you go. Mueller, what have you got up next?
I am leaving here to go and interview Jane Goodall.
Oh, right.
For future broadcast on Monocle 24.
Fantastic.
I think I'm allowed to say that.
You are allowed to say that. And thank you to my wing person, Sean Pattenden. and also to producer Sophie Black, who makes it all hang together and takes out the ridiculous bits where I make a fool of myself. Remember, dear listeners, you can hear all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/bigmouth. If you want to support the show, you can buy us a pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. And we're going to play about with a fantastic tune that we should have had on last week. Guest Steve Yates had to bail out with a man flu, but this is the track that he wanted to play. It's Korean DJ Peggy Gao. That's G-O-U, should you wish to download it. And a new single, It Makes You Forget. And in brackets, it's, I think this is a Korean word, itgahani, which possibly means it makes you forget. Anyway, have a listen, and we'll see you next week. This is Peggy Gao with It Makes You Forget.